Okay, this is now talking with Professor Kevin Westfold over the telephone from Sydney to Monash University in Victoria on 13 March, 78.
Okay, so could you just tell me what your educational background was and how you first got involved with radio astronomy?
Yes, well, I went to the University of Melbourne after school in 1940, must have been my first year. The war had started, and I did a course at Melbourne at that time, a combined mathematics-physics course, which enabled you to get the degrees of Bachelor of Arts with Honours and Bachelor of Science after 4 years.
Right.
Now, the only way, the only extra thing one had to do, as a matter of fact, was to take an extra subject in second year.
I see.
We did.
Let me just... So the bachelor's degree then came in 44 or so?
My first degree, I would have finished that in the end of 1942. Then in 1943, I would have done the third year physics course together with what people usually did with a subject called theory of statistics, but because of the war, we took a subject which is quite new called radio physics.
I see. And
I found that very difficult because being theoretically inclined, this was really talking about what went on inside a receiver and so on, and I found it a bit hard to take because I didn't have that sort of mathematical rigor that at that time I used to value most of all.
And this was not concerned with the ionosphere or things like that, but more just the hardware.
Oh, no, it had a bit of everything. It had problems with propagation. I certainly think I saw perhaps not the Hartree formula, but the Lorentz formula.
Okay. And then did you stay on for postgraduate work?
Yes, after that I went back to the mathematics department and worked with Tom Cherry, who's professor of mathematics, and he was interested in problems of diffraction. And I tried to work with him on that, and we finished up working in the subject of parabolic cylinder functions, which enabled you to talk about diffraction at cylindrical boundaries. And I also used to play around with Kotler, and he at that time was published, I think, in an Island de Physique, on various ways of doing conformal transformations to get shapes of horns.
I see. So this is really applied mathematics.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sort of practical analysis, all the properties of parabolic cylinder functions is what interested Cherry, who was much more of an analyst than I was.
And you attained an advanced degree.
I got a master's degree.
I guess at that time there were no PhDs in Australia.
That's true.
If I remember correctly.
Yes, they're only just starting.
And then you came over to radio physics.
And then when I finished that master's degree in the first term, 1946, around that May, I'd already decided that, I started looking around for a job and found that they were calling for somebody with my qualifications to work in radio physics with Trevor Pearcey, who had recently joined them. He'd worked for TRE, I think, and perhaps RRDE, which were military establishments in Britain.
Right.
And when I got there, I sat in fact, in a room with PSC, and also Frank Kerr was there.
I see.
And Frank Kerr told me at the time, he was a Melbourneian himself. He said, "I believe you must be the chap they were angling for."
I see.
I'm not sure that at that time they hadn't heard about the
I see.
So they
But you did not work at first on radio astronomy then?
With PSC?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Pearcey was just supposed to direct me, and but Pearcey, because Pearcey had a theoretical background, but Pearcey was wanting Pearcey to see that I did work in particularly solar radio.
Oh, I see. Okay, so from the beginning, then, you did get involved.
Oh, I did, yes. The first job I was to do was to go through Abetti's book on the sun.
Oh, yes.
And go through all the... stuff and derive the numerical values, parameters, and so on that were of importance that would be of importance to propagation in the solar atmosphere. And so that's when I started looking at Lorentz theory and magneto-ionic theory at the same time.
I see. Okay, so Well, now, the first publication that you have in radio astronomy that I have is in 1949. That was 3 years after you arrived. So there must have been a lot.
I had a few lab reports. Now, probably if you have a look in the archives at Radio Physics, you'll see RPL 14 and 4 and a few things like that.
Okay.
Now, I was trying all the time to get something published, but Porty, if I may say so, was uncertain with theoretical people, and he couldn't believe that anything that I was doing really was.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons why he used to get John Jager to come up to Jager was very good in talking to people like Porty, and at the same time, he knew very well whether anything that theoretical people were doing was worthwhile.
I see. So he relied on Jager's opinion, more or less, as to...
A good deal, and Piercy's.
But
Piercy himself never did work in that particular area.
Yeah,
he was doing a lot on tropospheric propagation, carrying on with the work he'd been doing in England, getting the girls to do... He had a great big room full of computing girls with merchant machines. And,
oh, yes.
And Monroes, a couple of Monroes. And they used to spend all their time carrying out... fairly difficult ray calculations of tropospheric propagation, if I remember rightly.
I see. Now, so the difficulty basically was in convincing Pawsey somehow that this was worthwhile stuff that you were working on.
Well, I think I wasn't probably giving him the stuff that he particularly wanted. I started getting interested in problems of propagation. That's at a more advanced level. He also had Smerd, trying to get Smerd to work with me on it.
Right. And in fact, you did come up with a paper in 49 in Phil Mack.
Yeah, well, that has took a very great difficulty for that Smerd and Westphal paper to get published, I must say.
Why was that?
Well, just because Porty couldn't believe it was Wright and D.F. Martin, whom you will have heard about.
Oh, yes.
Was supposed to come and see us from time to time, and he was hoping that Martin would take some part in the direction of my work too, but Martin produced the draft of that paper of his on the quiet sun, and I didn't believe it was right, and the whole business of Smerd and Westphal, in fact, was to show that Martin was wrong.
I see. Now, what was the basic point of disagreement?
Well, Martin just had a couple of ad hoc things. He had two ways of getting an answer for the distribution of intensity across the solar disk. He was used in the ionosphere as calculating things called reflection coefficients.
Right.
Finding out the ratio between intensity that when it went up and by the time you got it when it's coming down. And he found that he was able to do this. Oh, one of the first things I did, by the way, was to calculate ray trajectories in some of these physics lab reports.
Right.
A whole set of those that were, but they weren't published, but at least they were available to people. Again, that didn't seem to be sufficient enough for a publication.
You and Steve Smerd must have been doing this more or less in parallel, or...
Who was?
You and Smerd must have been doing this in parallel.
Well, we were virtually doing it. We got together on it in the end. It was I think, who calculated the trajectories. But he was a kindred spirit, and we started working not so much in parallel, but together.
Right, okay.
He, in fact, produced one of these radio physics lab reports with a whole set of the parameters that were of use to radio astronomers. In fact, I've got a whole set of these things on my shelves here.
Yeah, I have seen that RPL series, and I'll check those out more closely. I interrupted, though. You were talking about the difference between your approach and Martin's.
And Martin's. Well, that seemed to be... Well, that would work all right when you could say that on a ray trajectory there was a beginning and an end.
Yes.
And around by the edges of the corona, this was so, away from the center of the disk. But when you got into the center of the disk, Martin was flummoxed because he just couldn't do this.
Yes.
So he read through. He was very, very close to Richard Woolley, who was the director of the Mount Stromlo Observatory
right.
at the time. And... he lived up there, of course. And in the library there, he found his encyclopedia, the Handbook d'Astrophysique.
Yes, Handbook de Physique, yeah.
No, I think it's
the French.
As well as the Handbook de Physique, there was the Handbook d'Astrophysique. And in it, there's a band 3/1, There's a big and important section called Thermodynamics of the Stars by E.A. Milne, with whom I worked later.
Yes.
And that has got in it a section saying that the average distance from which radiation, thermal radiation, come layers of stars where there was a lot of absorption,
right,
if you went to semi-infinite medium, that the average distance was at optical depth tau equal to 1.
Right.
So what Martin said, okay, if the thing doesn't stay in the corona and have make contributions all the way in the optically thin, if you like, trajectories near the limb of the sun, I can do that with my reflection coefficient. The other ones, where you calculate the optical depth as you go in, as soon as you get to where tau is equal to 1, here you've got the temperature of the radiation.
Oh, yes.
Had a model of from somewhere. You'll see it in his...
It was more or less just...
the temperatures of the solar atmosphere, and he just picked off the temperature where tau equals 1, so that was the radiation temperature.
So it was just sort of a simplistic, straightforward...
And I wrote, I think in my... I went on holiday up in Queensland, and I wrote something in the form of a letter to Nature. I hadn't decided what to do, but I wrote it and I sent it down from Queensland. Stupid, of course, to do all that sort of work in your holidays. and sent it to the and Tappy Bowen, who was the chief of the division,
right,
sort of walked in when Sally Atkinson, I think, was typing it. And he got terribly upset because he and Martin had been at loggerheads.
Yes.
And he just couldn't bear the idea of anything coming from the lab, which, you know, had just set out A, B, C, and D, what was wrong with what I saw to be wrong, and I still believe was wrong with Martin's treatment of analyzing it and pulling it to bits. And he said to me when I came back, you know, it's all very well to be critical and find out what's wrong with the thing, but I couldn't possibly send this. You must wait and produce the definitive treatment, if you can say what's wrong. And so that's what happened when this Merton-Westfold paper that was in Film Mag.
I see. So there never was anything for Nature at that period, right?
No, that didn't go. But that was the sort of thing that I found that they used to be trusted. I think probably the judgment was right.
That in
principle, it is better not to just be wholly destructive, because otherwise you don't make steps forward. But I thought Martin was dishonest about it, because, you see, I had set this stuff up to Martin, and Martin showed it to Woolley, and that's all I knew that happened. But this was in response. He first wrote a letter to Nature himself, and then he produced a draft to send to the Royal Society, which was, of course, was the acme of the publication.
Right.
And I think when I wrote that thing, it had been sent to the Royal Society, but that was it.
Hmm.
Well, Woolley didn't dissuade him from doing it. I don't know whether he tried to, but Martin just went ahead and took no notice.
Yes.
Woolley did take some notice of it, to the extent that I had been a bit inept, I think. Maybe this was a draft thing I'd written which developed the ideas a bit further, but I had not got the equation of transfer in the form that with a refractive index satisfactorily included. And Woolley, in fact, wrote or delivered in Western Australia a Masson lecture.
Yes.
And that was the first time, I believe, that the refractive index was properly incorporated into the equation of transfer. It wasn't a source of interest in optical work.
Yes.
But I think that was a result of Martin showing my attempts at it to Woolley.
So you think
that's... I was sore with Martin Vanilla making any response to that thing of mine. It seemed to me that, in fact, he was dishonest.
Yeah.
Either in not saying that I was wrong or explaining why I was wrong in my criticisms, and not making any response at all. And I was always a bit sore about that, and I think Woolley knew I was, but Woolley could understand the sort of basic physical ideas, or he thought he could understand those ones of Martin's, whereas ours, which were somewhat more sophisticated, involving emission and absorption along a trajectory.
And more high-powered mathematics and so forth.
They did end up by having that. And Pawsey, in fact, never did concede this, and you'll see again in this RPL series a paper Borsi called Notes on the Detailed Balancing Derivation of the Laws of Thermal Emission.
Yes, I remember seeing that, right.
Well, that's, to my mind, still a lot of nonsense, but he wrote that just to try to persuade the absurd that, this was just a valid way of handling it, and certainly it meant more to him than absurd in Westfold.
I see, interesting. Now,
I think, in fact, that paper may have been written a bit before. This other one that you're talking about in the Australian Journal of Physics, a whole lot of these, my work was all pent up in a way, and it was just released more or less at the same time.
Yeah, I can see now that an awful lot came out in 49 and 50 all at once.
I was also working on solar thirst, you see, because Ruby Payne Scott and so on was interested in this, and I had the bright idea that this tailing off was an ether of the miners' new tea kind of phenomenon in intensity. That was a sort of record they made. It was still exponential, and I knew that some things I've been studying in plasma oscillations or just straight oscillations, that when you had a damping term, you got an ether of the miners' new tea as well as the...
Right, so this is the article
one of the things I suggested to.
With Jager on transient bursts.
And then later on, Jager came along and said, this is the kind of thing that I can do with the Laplace transform, which you've been using for good effect in other areas. I think he's written a book on it, I think. And so he wrote this other paper with me, but he did most of it himself, but he was gracious enough to have me in it for having thought of the idea.
I see. Now, going back, Martin now was on the staff at Mount Stromlo, is that correct?
Oh, no, he's still on CSIRO staff, but he was offered hospitality by Woolley at Mount Stromlo.
I see, which...
just a chief scientist at large.
At large, I see. Wasn't really connected with any division.
No, I think he may have been connected with radio physics, but I think he was at large.
I see. And also, it's interesting that you bring up this point of disagreement or... annoyance with Martin, because there was a similar incident which may have been just before you got here about with Pawsey about the very bright corona being very hot and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Martin also there more or less stole an idea without giving any credit for it.
Well, he had that reputation. V.A. Bailey, who was professor of physics, one of the professors of physics at Sydney University, used to work with him on ionospheric problems, and they were sworn enemies by the time I got up there, and I think it was all because Bailey observed that Martin had pitched some ideas on it.
Hmm. Now, it seems then that the theorists in this group, which of course were a distinct minority, were in a bit of a tricky position, because... Well, of course, there were a lot of other junior people. What I'm getting at is that I've heard a lot of praise for the scientific direction that Pawsey gave to the experimenters and so forth, but it seems like that perhaps he didn't quite have the insight as to how to handle, so to speak, the theorists.
I think he found us an embarrassment, and I admit had the same sort of thing. But some of the other chaps were very nice to me, complaining, being much kinder about it when I felt frustrated. Reminding me that what a great man Pawsey was, and I think he was now, but at the time I just felt the frustrations, I think.
Hmm. But you stuck with it anyway, and...
I didn't have much option.
Yeah.
I got a CSIR overseas studentship, which got me out of his hair.
And when was that now?
Well, you see, that was in 1949.
And where did you go?
I went to Oxford.
I see. I didn't realize that.
I went there to work with Chapman. And Chapman, I saw that he agreed that he would take me, because I was interested in determining things like the absorption, the effect of collision frequency on the absorption coefficient. And you see, in Smerton Westfold, we talked about this factor 4/3 that was a discrepancy that ought to be fixed up.
Factor 4/3 in what?
In the absorption coefficient.
Mm-hmm.
What you had to use was not collision frequency, but some parameter.